I'm Beth Pariseau, senior news writer at TechTarget, and this is IT Ops Query Season 1, Tech's Tragedy of the Commons. I'm here today with Bruce Perens, who created the definition of open source and co-founded the Open Source Initiative in 1998. He has said in recent public interviews, however, that open source has failed and called for its overhaul. Welcome, Bruce. Want to tell us more about what you meant by that?
So open source is incredibly successful and a failure at the same time. And I'm going to explain that. First of all, we've taken over business software. We've in fact made it possible for companies like Google to happen at all. Because if you look at those companies, they are built on open source software. And obviously Google has made a ton of money, employs a lot of people who contribute to open source. But take it from my perspective as an independent open source developer. I write this stuff to help people. I don't write it to make rich people richer. I'd still be working for Pixar. We have failed at reaching the common person. You've probably got an iPhone or a Google-based phone, and they have open source within them. It is, for the most part, systems programming. Both systems actually have an open source operating system kernel, the part that the user never, ever touches, but the computer wouldn't boot without it. And when you come to the user stuff, though, the actual applications that the users interact with, those are proprietary to Google, Apple, other companies. And they all have a monetization scheme of the user being the product. So what they do is they surveil you. Some would say they even oppress you. And so here we have open source software that people like me make simply for helping people. I'm an independent. I don't work for Google. I just write software for myself and to share with other people. And I would rather that it not be used to surveil you. So I would rather that open source reach the common person, that instead of using the Apple or Google app, that you were using an open source app where everything inside it was visible to security researchers, where we could tell if it was eavesdropping on you or doing anything else that you might not want. Okay, so why is that not happening now? Because open source developers write for themselves and people like them. And that's actually why we've been so popular with business and why we've taken over the systems programming area so effectively, because that's what we are personally good at. So how do we get these folks to program for the common person? Well, pay them. Okay, next question is, how do you pay them? Which is where I get to post-open, what comes after open source, and how it should make money from some people and help the common person and not make money from them.
So tell me more about the post-open concept. What exactly do you propose?
Post-open is the successor to open source in my mind. And it is not open source and will never pretend it's open source. For that reason, we start with a different name. Open source will continue. It will still have the same rules. Rules are actually even embedded in United States law now because of court cases. So we're not pulling the rug out from anyone. That's the first thing I want to say. So post-open changes the paradigm, and it requires a good deal more organization. And I'm going to get into this. This may never happen. This is a plan at this point. So the idea is we make software, and all entities that make under $5 million end user revenue, and it has to be end user because it's easy to circumvent if it isn't. I used to work for film companies. We used to say if your film made a profit, you were doing your accounting wrong. And so if you make more than $5 million end user revenue mm-hmm. per year, for compliance, you audit once a year what software you're using. You report that to us, and you pay a certain amount of that revenue. It's under 1%.
Okay.
So the idea is that the larger companies would be paying for software, and they would also be able to get support. And support is a very interesting question in the open source world.
Yeah.
Because if you get it today, it's very often support from a single company for a single product. And that is absolutely awful for the customer because, say, you're an enterprise, you're using 200 open source programs, something breaks. The first thing you have to do is find out which is wrong, which is a lot of time. Second thing you have to do is convince the vendor that it's their problem, and they're all busily pointing at each other. Post-open would have what I call at the moment collection organizations, say between 1 and 3. People are telling me you should have more than one so that people can choose among them. And the collection organization would collect funds and funnel those funds to open source maintainers. And that takes two pieces. So one is we have reports from people on what software they're using. And when I say using, that means internal use, performance, which is software as a service, and shipping in a product, which is embedded systems or shipped software. So they report on that to us, and then we instrument Git. So Git is a very common source code maintenance system. And so say you're instrumenting GitHub, you know what developers have made contribution. Now we know roughly who the maintainers are. There are some people that are called software janitors and software architects who might have to put in a time card.
Okay.
Because their work is not necessarily typing in lines of code as much as it is thinking about it, making designs, finding bugs, etc. We figure out how to pay all of these people from the Deep Pockets entities, and we pay them. What do the Deep Pockets entities get? First of all, compliance becomes much easier. It's this once-a-year process. And that is very important because if you look at big companies, they are spending $7 million a year on an open source compliance department.
Right. So just from covering software supply chain security, I also have heard about some pretty gnarly complexity in the layers of open source software that people are using within products. And that's why the Log4j issue was so difficult to root out. So how would you deal with that many layered nature when it comes to collecting and distributing funds back to developers? If there's 100 or 200 different open source libraries built on top of one another in a piece of finished software, how do you allocate the revenue accordingly?
Well, maintainers are probably compensated by an algorithm that basically works on lines of code. And that's not always the best way, and I've budgeted for half a year on working on the process of this, and I'm sure that that will be one of the problems that we deal with. What happens is if you have N lines of code that have survived until today, because the stuff I wrote in the Linux kernel is all gone, someone overwrote it, then you take that program and you look at popularity. So very many companies are running Log4j, for example. So you get compensated a reasonable lot for that. Now, I wanted to get back into support for a moment.
Sure.
The difference we can do is because we're presenting a unified front for the entire post-open software collection. We support the whole thing. And that's really important because today, IBM gets the support contracts, and that is because they say they will support everything. So the customer has one throat to choke, and we want to give the customer something as close as possible to that, and maybe get there eventually when we're a big enough organization. And then what happens to the developer? The developer is no longer the direct contact with the software support customer. We have people who do that. They talk to the developer. The developer does maintenance. They will be much happier that way. They are only in the support business because they need to make money. And frankly, there are a few ways to make money from open source, pure open source. If you do this, what's called widget frosting, having a non-open source additive, sure, you can make money that way, but we're now defeating the purpose of open source.
So it also sounds a bit to me like what Tidelift is doing. How is it different from their approach?
Well, Tidelift is an interesting company in that they're offering support and they're funneling some of the money from support back to the developer. Mm-hmm. But what we're actually talking about is more directly paying the developer for their work. Whereas Tidelift, no one's doing business with Tidelift because they feel a need to pay for open source. They're doing business with Tidelift because they need the support. You know, we have this basic issue with open source, which is it's free. And, you know, not just free as in freedom, as Richard Stallman used to say, but free as in price being zero. And companies don't even care that it's free anymore. It used to be that it was easier than their purchasing process, but that is not true any longer because compliance is becoming progressively a bigger deal, especially with the EU laws where everyone has to have a BOM and identification, something that Debian has been doing since the 1980s, by the way. This is not new in the open source world. We used to have certificate signing parties before there was effectively an internet. And we knew every Debian developer, and if someone had put in something malicious, we could prosecute them. So this is really a 40-year-old concept here.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, and I think that open source projects of note have been doing that. They've not always been very loud about it. Maybe they've been keeping the information to themselves. But this EU thing did not come as a great shock to me. And in the United States, you can go back even further, and we have Sarbanes-Oxley. And Sarbanes-Oxley says your software must be supported if it has input to your financial reporting. And thus, we have many companies who are using open source who actually go out and get the contracts. I've seen many of my customers just pay for it because they feel better about paying for it.
And I mean, that's how Red Hat built its business.
Yeah, but people have to realize that when you pay Red Hat and when you are a member of the Linux Foundation, that is not making its way back to the developer. In fact, there was a recent statistic about Linux Foundation putting 3% of its revenue into Linux. And this needs to change. And unlike in 1987, when we started open source, we're at the point where everyone understands that there is value here and that they are willing to pay for it. And the developers are looking up and saying, hey, I want this. I want to write open source all day and make a living instead of having to go to work for Google and having 10% of my time to do it.
Are they, though? Because, you know, this may be somewhat tangential as an issue, but OpenSSF and Linux Foundation have been trying to raise $150 million for software security in open source, and they haven't come close. Do you think there is really an appetite to pay out there?
Well, I think they might be the wrong organizations to do it. There's always this sort of tangential nature in that here's an organization, you know, some of them have millions of dollars to be on their steering board, you know, maybe tens of millions in case of Linux Foundation now. And they're going to collect money and fund the software developers. And, you know, first of all, if you look at these entities, Linux Foundation has the money. They're spending it on the wrong things. Also, if you look at salaries, they're astronomical. And, you know, the developers, if they look at the salaries in the Linux Foundation, I think they'd be rather hurt. So I think there's very much, you know, not thinking about this in the world by people who are trying to do good and increasingly are seeing that there are lots of people making money on their backs. And so when I talk about this at conferences that are full, absolutely full of open source developers, I don't get pushback. You know, 5 years ago, I might have, but everybody has the point now. And that's actually come as a bit of a shock to me. Everyone's okay with, hey, maybe we should move on.
This is also somewhat separate but related, but vendors and for-profit companies are looking more at business source licenses, functional source licenses, delayed open source. What do you think about that as far as separating the for-profit from not-for-profit?
Well, I worked on the business source license with Monty Redenius, and he's a MariaDB now, formerly MySQL founder. And Monty is a very interesting guy. He actually wrote the whole database.
Yeah.
One person. And this, essentially, the company sold for $1 billion. You know, now we laugh at a company that just sells for $1 billion. But back then, it was something special. And so all of the other programmers at MySQL up until that time were doing user mode and application, you know, helping out the customers, etc. Monty came to me, and Kai, also at MariaDB, came to me and said, we're working on this. And I helped them a bit in establishing some clarity in that this would definitely become open source under a specific license by a specific time. I think that's very important when you stick a name on something, that it actually stands for rules which are clear. And that was an important part about open source, was that there was an open source definition, and it's 26 years now.
Yeah.
We've had that same definition and people understand it. And I was looking in contrast at Creative Commons and, you know, there are five or six different paradigms in Creative Commons, and the only thing that they have in common is the right to read. So some of them you can modify the text, some of them you can resell it, some of it you can't. And from a branding, a marketing perspective, it bothers me when I look at a name and that name doesn't actually stand for very much. Okay, in the case of Creative Commons, right to read is important, but there should have been more. There should have been more fundamental rights in my mind, and there were with open source. And I would have it that with post-open or whatever we eventually call it, because it has to be a trademarkable name, that there be clear rules and that the common person should be able to use the software without reading the license. And that was actually also a goal for open source, one that we haven't entirely met, but for the most part, common person can use that software, and until they go to modify it or redistribute it, there's no reason for them to actually read the license. Okay, those people in the $5 million plus bracket, they can afford to have lawyers tell them what licenses mean. But still, there should be just one license.
Why do you think people have arrived at the consensus that it's time to move on? How do you think that came about?
I think that jealousy is a big part of it, that people are looking around and seeing, hey, Amazon is performing my software. And Jeff Bezos owns a rocket ship company that he paid for with this money. And it's in a billion phones made by Samsung, who's doing really well. And gee, well, I'm their unpaid employee.
And then there's companies like HashiCorp that they're saying we aren't able to fund our development with a traditional open source license. What's your reaction on that?
Well, they're right. They can't. Okay. So we have the life cycle of the open source company, which is we come out with a product, we open source it in order to get market share. Okay. Open source has been great at getting market share. Okay. In a year or so, we've now received venture funding. We have people who very definitely are putting pressure on us to make money. Working for a venture capitalist is not easy. You have to have an exit strategy. You have to be tracking it. I've worked for a VC firm. I understand. So now you get to the point where, well, gee, we've gotten all of this stuff from open source, but we're not making enough money. So we have to jump off of the bandwagon in some way. So we go to the Commons Clause, for example, which is created by my dear friend Heather Meeker, but she made a mistake. And the mistake that she made is, I'm going to talk about branding again. Open source has a brand that says what it means. And when you attach the Commons Clause to an open source license, it no longer does what the brand says, but it still has the open source license. So there's definite brand confusion. There's a judge in San Jose who's hearing the Neo4j case. He understood this and he said, you can't call it open source if you do this. Unfortunately, that case will go to appeal for other reasons, so we'll see if that still stands. But I think that it was important that you actually do what the brand says you do, and the Commons Clause breaks that. It says, we're open source, but we're really not, and you have to pay us.
Does the post-open approach address any of that life cycle of an open source company?
Yeah, because what it does is, you're making open source, it is still a front-loaded process, okay? Because you're going to have to make it, you're going to have to gain market share, and then you start getting paid. Well, this is not very much unlike commercial software, because commercial software, similarly front-loaded, you take investment, you spend a few years developing your software, you start to sell it. So I think that post-open, besides funding the individual developer, will become a viable paradigm for for-profit companies. And so here are these companies, they're paying their people, they're making software that you and I, because we're not $5 million companies, can use for free. It's intended to help us, and that these deeper pockets entities are supporting. And so you also get the issue of, well, someone wants to modify the post-open software. Well, they can either contribute their software back as a post-open license, okay, in which case they're now on the money-making bandwagon too, or say they want to keep it private for some reason, they have to start paying. And then they get the right to keep their pieces private, and they pay like that $5 million plus entity, even if they aren't one. Mm-hmm. And they get the right to have private modifications of the software that way. So we've actually repaired the economic cycle, because we used to take payment in software. We put out software under the GPL. All the companies that wanted to extend it had to share it under the GPL or similar license. So we were getting software back. Now, some people don't want to give software back, and we did not provide a path for them to give money back instead. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to do this. And this is the way the whole economy has worked for an awful long time.
Yeah.
So for us to put ourselves back in a little more normal flow of money and preserve the freedom, the disclosed nature of the software, the fact that it's helping the little guy, it just sounds like win-win to me. Hmm. Now, the problem of this is open source was really simple. You had a license, you didn't have to sign it, you could go use the software right away. What we're talking about now is having entities that collect money. They have to be trusted enough that people join in an agreement with them, that it doesn't fork 200 different ways, because if it does, this doesn't work for anyone. So there's a really big PR and trust issue here,
yeah,
in the way the organizations work, that the agreements are drafted so that they enforce fairness for everyone. And this is why I now want to sit down and spend half a year of my time on process and $100,000 of legal work. Mm. Because I'm not a lawyer, and I know better than to write licenses or agreements on my own. I've seen how that fails in the open source world. And so I want to do this with a lawyer. And there are other issues that will come up with the lawyer, like how do you do this without antitrust becoming mm-hmm. an issue? Although if antitrust becomes an issue, we're doing really, really well.
Right.
So
true. One of those good problems to have.
Yeah. So I think that this will take a year mm-hmm. to come out with a concrete proposal. And by the way, I know by now that I can't satisfy everyone. I'm only out to satisfy the people that want to jump on this bandwagon. And there is open source, which is not going away for anybody who likes it better.
Right. It'll be very interesting. I plan to follow closely what happens on this topic. And I really appreciate you being with us to tell us about your work and your view on this.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate your time and the time of the audience to listen to this.
This has been ITOps Query Season 1, Tech Tragedy of the Commons. If you have any feedback on this episode or want to share questions or stories we should consider covering, please reach out to me at bpariso, that's B as in boy, P as in Peter, A, R, I, S as in Samuel, E, A, U, at techtarget.com. Please also consider rating, reviewing, or subscribing to this podcast on your platform of choice. And tune in next week for our continued conversations with industry experts about open source principles and sustainability. Thank you for being with us so far.